Greetings, everyone, and welcome to another installment of Innovation Crush. It is me, Chris Denson, your gracious host.
Yay!
You're just going to dance to nothingness? Is that what's going to happen?
That's a great thing about not having cameras right now, is that we can be super silly and nobody will know.
I know. But by the way, if you guys are tuning in for the first time ever, this show covers all things marketing, innovation, ideas, creativity, smart people doing smart things. And I'm kind of intimidated today. First of all, I have a guest whose voice is almost deeper than mine. So I feel like I got to man up a little bit. Say hello, Hakeem.
Hi, how
see
how
what
are you
see
doing?
What I mean?
Nice to meet you, Chris.
Awesome.
You know,
nice
don't even here. Talk. Yeah. I'm just going to talk to Peely. Peely, say hello. How are you?
Hello, everybody. I'm good. I'm excited to be here. So thanks for the invitation.
I know, and you're so professional. You outclass me in the hosting department.
I don't know about that, but yes, I've been a TV host for many years now. Started off as a VJ at MTV, and now I have my own show, and I won an Emmy, and this is awesome. And Hakeem is like, this bumping me, yeah.
I'm your silent celebrations. Like you nailed it. Like you're doing silly stuff, but like
I'm a serious scientist, Chris.
I don't do silly.
That's right. But just excited to be here and to share this time with you, with Chris, who's pretty awesome as well. So
I knew you, Peely. I knew it.
You knew it.
I knew
right?
it. I knew the name. I didn't know.
You're like this name.
New York.
Familiar.
Chicago.
Chicago.
Detroit. Inside joke, everybody.
Inside joke. That's why I love aliens. Alienating my audience.
There you go.
Hakeem.
Yes.
I guess for starters, how about you give us the 90-second version of Hakeem Oluseyi?
Oh, yes.
I've been practicing, by the way.
All right. Yes. That was really, really good. I don't think anyone ever has said it so well. All right. So 90-second version of Hakeem. I'm a very curious guy, so I do science. I like to think of myself somewhat as like a science mercenary, you know? So I've worked in different fields. Wherever there's a problem, let me just go solve it. Hey, didn't somebody say that in a rap? If there's a problem,
I'll solve it. Check out, as my DJ revolves it.
Are we quoting Vanilla Ice? Let me
put this out here.
We didn't just quote him. We channeled him.
Let me put this out here because I feel like, listen, if you were around then, you know that that song was the jam. So everybody's dissing Vanilla Ice because he wore the big pants and everything.
No, Ice Baby
dominated.
We're here at Innovation Crush, and Vanilla Ice was one of my first crushes.
Oh, there you go. And he was innovative. He was Eminem before there was Eminem.
Exactly.
He was transitioned between Beastie Boys and Eminem. Like it was like he was the mishap face.
I just loved how he shaved his eyebrows. Yeah. You guys remember that?
Right. So cool. You know, having a big hit like that. Remember Third Base? They never did that.
Right. Gas Face. So continue. That was a good tangent.
So
if there's a problem, you'll solve it.
Yeah, there's a problem, I'll solve it. But you know, I also love people and helping people. So I also like travel around the world and try to do for others what was done for me. So, you know, I was this little kid in various communities in the deep South, and people showed up and said, hey man, you know, why don't you get into this, why don't you get into that, and it led to me being a scientist today. And had those people not shown up, it wouldn't have happened, right?
Yeah.
So that's exactly what I do now. So I travel around the world doing this, actually, right? And I work with other people of similar mind, right? And so what people don't know is that there's this giant army that I like to consider Earth's mightiest superheroes that are dedicated to just bringing people out of poverty and improving lives through education and science education. And, you know, it also transitions into service. So I can announce here today.
Yeah.
I'm about to.
Exclusive.
How did LeBron break it? What was his words? I'm taking my talents to South Beach or something like that?
Something like that.
Yeah. Well, I'm about to take my talents to D.C. I'm about to join NASA headquarters. So
amazing.
This announcement here, yeah, next month I'll be there.
Nice.
Yeah.
Good for you.
But that's, again, thank you, service to America.
Silent disco.
Yeah. But, you know, I'm very service-oriented.
Right.
So also, a lot of it is national service. So I've worked a lot with NASA, National Science Foundation, DARPA, U.S. State Department.
Well, it's interesting. You don't typically hear the word service and science together. I mean, you know, not as, you know, glued tightly together as you just did. How did that piece come? Because you mentioned, like, the people that came to you as a youth and were like, hey, why don't you get involved? Like, what does that look like? What does that look like? And how does it translate into where you are now?
You know, it's really interesting because the community that I'm from. So I was just talking about this to an old high school classmate. He's old. I'm not. But what we sort of got this like idea of service down there in Mississippi. So even when I was in college, I was a part of fraternity. We were always doing service stuff. We'd work with a school called Pineywood School. It was an all male school, at least at the time.
Right.
But check this out though, right? So most scientists, I think, are professors. And as a professor, you're supposedly judged on three things: research, teaching, and service. But the universities treat it like research is the only thing that matters, right? So you could be great at teaching, you could be great at service, but if you're not bringing in the money, putting out the papers, graduating the PhDs, see ya. You're not getting tenure, right? But you know, for me, service is a part. So it's even worse. If you are doing a lot of service, a lot of your colleagues feel like, you know, sort of like if you're Shaquille O'Neal and you start making movies, they feel like you're not being serious about basketball, right?
Right.
So if I'm out there trying to inspire kids and writing books and all this, they feel like, oh, you're not a serious scientist, researcher. You need to be in the lab, right? And so the way I lived most of my career was to actually spend the 12, 16 hours a day in the lab and still go and do that stuff, right? And, you know, it took a toll. And so now that I'm almost 21, you know, I got to slow down.
Yeah, no, I can see that.
I got to say, though, you mentioned that people were showing up when you were growing up, people were showing up for you, and they're the ones that introduced science to you, but also because you were really curious, right? Have you always been very curious about the world?
Yeah, I've really been interested in the topic, right? That's a key element of it. And so the way that happened was kind of weird, too. I was already interested in science before anybody introduced me to science. But what they introduced me to is how humans, the processes that are involved, right? How do you get into college? What is rigorous scientific research like? You know, what happened with me is that I moved every year. My mom and dad divorced shortly after I was born, and we moved every year. And it was always like the hood, like serious, hardcore Houston 3rd Ward, New Orleans 9th Ward, not Compton. What's the
claiming hoods you didn't know?
No, it wasn't Compton. Was it Compton? I forget.
South Central?
No, Watts. It was Watts. Yeah, yes. A little young kid in Watts. And so, you know, when you're the new kid in a bad neighborhood, you know, you got to fight somebody and, you know, and it's just kind of like, you know, sometimes I felt like I was running a gauntlet. So anyway, I'd read a lot, and I read this set of World Book Encyclopedias, the entire thing. And that's where I discovered Albert Einstein and physics.
So reading and science was your escape.
Reading and science was my escape. Exactly. Yeah.
What was it? And I find this, you know, with a lot of individuals, like, what was it about it that resonated with you? I mean, I've talked to hackers, I've talked to government officials, and it's usually like something like in your bones is like, oh, that's my thing.
Yeah, that's my thing, man. I was always really interested in the stuff that's weird. Right. So I don't know if you remember, there was Time Life books used to have like ghosts, you know, and all these mystery things. Right. And so this is a true story. I found out that if you were under 18, you can't be legally held to a contract. So I'd order these books from TV. Okay, right? I didn't have...
And you were smart. So
But, you know, I was born with this curiosity. So I think when I think about like the two things that were deep in me were survival instinct and curiosity, right? And just interest in the natural world and weird stuff.
Were you considered a weird kid?
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, I've been considered a weird adult a lot. But the weird thing is...
Can you fight, though?
I could. Oh, man. That was the other thing.
I mean, currently.
Currently.
I want to take you out. No, just...
Hey, well, I don't know, man. I'm not as fast as I used to be. And I don't heal as quick.
Right. But you probably know the scientific places to punch
out. I'll tell you a funny story, man. So when I was living in Mississippi, we had this pond. We used to come to these like crazy little rituals for no good reason. Right. And so one of them was that to be a member of the pond swimming group, you had to have a mud fight with somebody. Right. Now, the guy that I had to fight was the point guard on our basketball team. He was a couple of years older than me. This guy, his last name was Abney. I forget his first name, but he was an awesome athlete. So I thought this guy was just going to destroy me. And the exact opposite happened. Right. And so fear has been a great motivator in my life. So through a lot of those youth fights, like, I don't even know what happened. Right. You're just like,
right? Just going blacked out.
Yeah. And then you come through and they're like, man, you killed him. Really? I did? You know, not literally killed him. But.
We don't want to record that.
Yeah.
I find that there's this really you mentioned research and you kind of like the pillars of science, education and the industry. Exactly.
Yeah.
And just one of the thoughts I was having was, there's a lot of research that happens in science and it happens over years and years and years. And then there's very slow implementation And I could be absolutely wrong, but I think the public perception might be that, you know, is the, you know, and I think some of your work helps to bridge that gap, makes things more practical, but the actual implementation of like, hey, we found this thing, now let's go ahead and use it. And then, how do you, or does that come across your day to day? And like, how do you have to navigate that?
It's two different, you know, it's sometimes it happens really quickly. Like, let me give you one example. You remember when you went from these giant disks to suddenly these little thumb drives, like overnight? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was because of this new phenomenon in physics was discovered that led to a Nobel Prize. This concept known as giant magnetoresistance, right? And so that happened really fast, right? Then you look at some other things, right? Like, for example, superconductors. Superconductors, people have been hearing about that forever and ever and ever, but yet we don't have a world. It's still copper wires and fiber optics. Mm-hmm. Another one that happened quick was fiber optics, right?
Right.
So it all depends on the mode in which you're working and what you're working on. So sometimes physics and engineering coincide. So if you think about it this way, physics is what's responsible for discovering new phenomena, and engineering is how we take advantage of it. Let's now that we know this, let's make something, right?
Now, where does your specific area of expertise come in, right? Where it's astrophysics, it was one of yours.
Yeah, exactly.
One of a dozen. your scientific tool belt. But like, you know, in that instance, because I can almost understand the technology science, right? Yeah, like, okay, yeah, floppy disk to CD to thumb drive.
Right.
But, you know, meteorites and, you know, cyber dust like me as Joe on the street, like.
Exactly. You're absolutely right. So, when you try to justify science by saying, okay, this particular scientific study will lead to this exact outcome, right? So one of the things I just did, I just hosted an event in Vegas for DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Programs Agency, right? And what they funded, they're the people that funded the development, for example, of the self-driving car, which is something that you can see, you know, what the outcome is going to be. One of the things what we were doing is automated software that will find vulnerabilities in software so you're not getting hacked all the time, right? And so the thing about a DARPA-funded thing is that it may or may not work. If I am applying for my normal research grants through the National Science Foundation or NASA or the Department of Energy or whoever it is, it's judged based on technical feasibility. Will this work or will this not work, right? And so, you know, it all depends on how you phrase it. So let me give you an example. When people were studying motion at the microscopic scale, quantum mechanics, right?
Right.
What did that lead to? Your smartphone. Mm. But in the 1920s, they weren't thinking of smartphone. But people were like, who cares how the electron moves? Right. What does that have to do with my daily life, right? And the answer is that you just never know. But if you do fundamental research into how the universe behaves fundamentally, something amazing is going to come out of it, right? So you just have to do it. The nations that do it, those are the ones that you know, for example, look at all the how America dominates the web, right? So think about Google. Why was it made here? Why wasn't it made in France, right? Or England? Why was Facebook made in the U.S. and not in England, right? They're English speaking too, you know. But for some reason, that innovation culture that we have, you know, brings forth these things, and I think that starts with investment in basic fundamental research.
That's great. I mean, that's a good transition, too. I mean, I think with your travels around the world, having spoken around the world, what other things do you see that people are sort of either obsessed with the same way you were as a kid, or just even their innovation economy, you know, when it comes to the sciences and, you know, practical applications?
Well, you know what, man? What really gets me is I travel around the world. I'm big on social justice, right? Because let me tell you what happened to me. So I grew up, you know, in these communities that I talk to you about. Then I show up for graduate school at Stanford University, and I start talking to these other kids about their lives. And I'm like, holy cow, it didn't matter how smart I was blown out of the water before this race even began. Like, four of the guys in my research group, their dads were PhD physicists, right? My dad dropped out of school when he was 9 years old. How could I compete with that? Those guys cheated. Right? They cheated, right? Yeah. But so what I notice when I go around the world is how much we're not taking advantage of human talent. So when I was a kid, you know, had people not reached out, I would not have even known that physicists as a career option existed, mm-hmm. right? When I went to, when I was in high school, I thought you went to college to be one of four things: doctor, lawyer, teacher, or an engineer. And I had no idea what an engineer was, right? So what I do, you know, a part of what I've been doing is going around the world and just letting people know, yo, this exists, you know, and it pays very well and you have a great life and you can do it.
And it right? can be cool.
And it can be cool. Yeah. Well, when they see me doing it, of course, it's cool, right? I mean, that case closed, right? But seriously, and this has created a small army. And, you know, I'm not alone in this. There's other people that are doing it. But, you know, I have my, everybody has their niche, what they're good at, you know. And, you know, I just make things really approachable for people and mm-hmm. cool, right? Mm-hmm. They no longer feel so like it's this big, giant monster that they can't tackle. It's for those other people, but not us, right. You know? Yeah. Right.
So as a teacher, what have you learned the most from your students?
Yeah, small correction, as a professor.
As a professor.
I'm glad I didn't ask that question.
There's a difference, right? Hey, I love teachers,
as a tutor.
I love teachers.
As a tutor,
you can hire me to tutor you.
Hey,
if you're ready, Chris.
Well, we can get to this later, but my daughter just started yesterday at LA's first all-girls public STEM school.
Oh, nice.
Wow.
Congrats.
So you can come over anytime and beat her up in some science and math.
All right. Daddy's going to write the check. Is that what I'm doing?
How about an exchange? You know, you get to be on the show.
Is that how this works?
Exactly.
Every time I show up on the show, I got to give services. Yeah. I got to provide.
That's how it works.
You didn't read the release form you signed.
Oh, did I sign?
Sorry, Peely.
I'm sorry.
So as a professor.
So what have I learned from my students? You want the real answer? I don't know if I should say this, but as a professor, sometimes you act as a counselor, mm-hmm. right? And so I've typically had an open door policy, and I'm a personable guy, the problems that exist in the world and in people's lives and in families, you know, I've heard so much of that and dealt with so much of that, that, you know, it really, again, opened my eyes to a phenomena that, you know, I was blind to beforehand, you know, and it's what you deal with, right?
It's kind of like people are people. And I don't think you can be.
Well, it was worse than I thought. Sometimes
people are really people.
There's a lot going on behind closed doors that everybody's acting like everything's all good.
Right.
But really, you know, a lot of people, everybody has their struggles, and there's a lot going on that we don't get to see. And if you're in a counseling position, right, they come to you and you get to,
That's
whatever
a great
you can
point, because I think, you know, especially in very intellectual practices, you know, you have IQ and then you have EQ,
right?
And then, you know, I think if you're a Hakeem Olusheyi student, right, like you're probably high functioning intellectually, mm-hmm. And you probably haven't been able to entertain or really open up on the emotional side. Yeah. And I mean, do you find that in the science community as a whole, like? Because you're a very personable person, you know, individual. Yeah. And like, there's a Michelle Thaler, there's a Dan Goods, there's individuals like that.
But those are breaking the stereotypes
of
scientists.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, by the way, I'm going to be working side by side with Michelle at NASA. What do you know?
She's an alumni of the show.
No way.
We love Michelle.
I can't wait to see her in person. I'll tell you a funny story. So I'm a huge nerd. So I'm a fan of other people that do science stuff. And one guy I was a fan of was Michio Kaku. Mm-hmm. Right, because I read his book Hyperspace when I was a grad student, and it totally changed my life. I had never heard of the higher dimensional physics, that sort of stuff, right? It just totally blew my mind, and, you know, set me on another path of mercenary action. So anyway, I joined Discovery and Science Channel Science Advisory Board in 2008, and it was a small number of scientists on the board, like 5 or 7, somewhere around there, and we had a big meeting when it started at Discovery headquarters, and sitting on the table there were your little nameplates to tell you where you're going to sit. And who am I sitting right next to? Michio Kaku, right? So I'm like, oh my God. So when we sit down, I reach over before we start, I lean over and I say, Professor Kaku, I just want you to know, you know, your book Hyperspace, it changed my life. And he responded, yeah, whatever, dude, shut up. So not literally.
Right.
But, you know, that's the thing about physicists. That, you know, we have this arrogance sometimes. I don't, but physicists, you know.
You're fine.
You're taught by older physicists, you know, you should be arrogant. So I was going somewhere with that. I was going to tell you. What was your original question?
I think it was
Peely's question. No, it was your question.
What did I ask?
Yeah.
I'm just going on this emotional journey with you. Oh, yeah. IQ and EQ.
EQ, exactly.
Look, subconsciously, I brought that back. I was like, I'm going on an emotional journey.
How was I connecting that to that story? IQ and EQ. Oh, yeah. So anyway, the the thing about being a physicist, you know, every community is different. So when you say scientists, there's different communities of scientists. And just like, you know, if I'm hanging out with the community of people in Brevard County, Florida, or Jasper County, Mississippi, or, you know, Santa Clara County, California, they're going to be very different based on, you know, the community culture.
Sure.
And so in physics, you know, who becomes physicists? Right. So there is sort of a stereotype of the science nerd that you see in the Big Bang Theory, for example.
Right.
That is so accurate. If you want,
really?
Yeah, if you want to characterize Caltech physicists, or so, that is so accurate. I mean, oh, now wow. I'm like, oh, my God, I know guys exactly like each of these
changing?
People.
Huh? You don't think it's changing?
Well, it is changing somewhat. But here's what happens. When you're from a different type of community and you join this other community, like, for example, you're, you know, P. Lee from
Puerto Rico.
London. And
Puerto Rico.
So,
oh, you're from London?
Puerto Rico.
No, I'm from Puerto Rico.
I know, Alaska somewhere.
Did you hear my accent?
I'm just
going
to make something
accent?
Up. Yeah.
Exactly.
But if you go to Alabama, probably you'll have a Southern accent before long, right? If you
right.
Yeah.
And so people conform to whatever culture you're put in. And you know what? One of the magical moments for me was, you know, coming from where I came from, to going into Stanford University, right? You know, I totally felt like I had to be somebody different than who I was, right? I had to talk a different way. Well, I had to talk so people could understand me. So that was...
Yeah. Step one.
Step one, exactly, right? Because nobody could understand me when I showed up, right? For some reason, if you don't add consonants and you speak really fast, people don't understand you. But what ended up happening is when I just said, forget it, you know, I'm just going to be me, right? That's when things worked a lot better for me. But I still see that, like, take this phenomenon, for example. I love Ted, right? Mm-hmm. But have you ever noticed when you see Ted talks that the people kind of all behave and speak in a
it's
very
the same
similar
way
manner?
They all have the same speaker trainer.
Exactly. And there is no speaker trainer, right? It's just that people have right. in mind this story, right? And you
or this
fall
is what
in
it
line
should look like.
This is what it should look like. Exactly. It's just like authority, right? Like the voice of authority has a certain look and sound and, you know, yeah.
And it's just like that.
It's just like me, right? Yeah, that's right. But it's not.
Well,
and so
I think you just touched on something really interesting, right? It's you said when you decided to be you, you know, kind of talk about that transition of like, what were you trying to be? And then when were you like, ah, fuck it. Here, like,
exactly.
Here.
I said forget it, but that's what I really thought.
Right.
Yeah, and how did you, like, overcome that internal battle that you were going through?
Yeah. Well, so first off, when I showed up there, I was woefully undereducated in comparison to everyone else, right? So my small college in Mississippi, it was an all black college, and the problem is in comparison is expectation level. So our professor, you know, this guy was amazing. He produced all these physicists from this small little black college in Mississippi. He was a Harvard graduated. He was a Harvard. He got his PhD at Harvard. No, Caltech. He got his PhD at Caltech. And the thing, though, is that you have these kids coming in from a variation of educational backgrounds. And my K-12 educational background in mathematics and science, it wasn't strong at all. The strength came from my own personal studies. And so the curriculum did not expect a lot of the students.
Right.
Right. And so it was very low level. So that didn't prepare you. That didn't prepare me for Stanford University. So as an example, when you have your mathematics books, like your calculus books, your physics books, at the end of each chapter, there are problems. And some of these problems have a little mark to indicate that they're extra difficult. Okay. Right. When I was at Tougaloo, we were never assigned those problems to do. When I got to Stanford, we were only assigned those problems to do. Right. So it was a big difference in expectation level. And then the other thing was that, you know, I was kind of a popular guy in high school, in college, you know, and I show up at Stanford, I'm pretty much invisible, right? Like my style was all wrong. You know, I just, yeah, I sounded all wrong. People were like, what's up with this freak, right? So inside I was, the bigger battle was, first off, that educational gap that I had to make up. And then there was the sort of like social capital that you walk in with. So they give you a sheet with all your first year physics students. So there were 10 in physics, 10 in applied physics. You read down the list, right? And they give you their school they're from. It's like Harvard, Princeton, Yale, right. Cambridge, Oxford, Landau Institute, Tougaloo College, right? And so, you know,
it's like paying right back up to that. What, Tougaloo?
Yeah, exactly, right? So everybody is interested, like, yeah, so.
Wait, how did you say that?
But then also because,
how did you get in? Is really, yeah. Yeah, I think you somehow, something went wrong. How did you end up here? So there's all this, you know, doubt that's placed on you. And so when I look at for example, and I use this when I counsel students, right? So if you go into an institution, and so in certain fields, you know, like, for example, how many prominent scientists do you know that have a deep Southern accent? None. Right? Because to have a Southern accent is to be dumb, right? That's how people think.
To have any accent, because I'm Puerto Rican, so I have a Latino accent, and I really do think that some people think I'm dumber than I actually am because of my accent.
Well, you know what? If we weren't on air, I could go on and on with that, but I make all kind of jokes, but I'm not.
Yeah, this is like one of those walked into a bar kind of jokes. Yeah. Like a Puerto Rican. What is Olusheyi, by the way? Is that?
It's Yoruba.
What is that?
Yeah, it's a Nigerian people.
There we go.
Nigerian people. They're primarily Nigerian.
Two layers deep.
There we go. So what were we talking about?
No, it's just so that transition. Battles. Yeah, exactly.
Oh yeah, yeah. So no, it was really severe, and you know, people were mean to me. As a matter of fact, you know, I can tell you stories about that as well. And so what happened is, within my first year, I completely went into isolation. Like I completely worked by myself. And when you start the upper division physics classes. So I did 2 years of undergrad classes when I started at Stanford. And so the upper division junior senior level classes are even tougher than graduate classes. And they tell you on the first day of class in most of those classes, hey, you know, you have to work with other people, otherwise you're going to fail, right? But I was so socially ostracized and people had been so mean to me that I actually just completely went in isolation and worked by myself. And it took another entire year before this guy reached out to me. He now works for NASA Ames, this guy named Paul Estrada, right? To say, hey, you know, work with us. You know, at first I thought, I was like, who does this weird dude keep following me around everywhere? And then I worked with Paul, and everything worked out really well. And then I took the grad courses and the same thing happened. So I went in there getting the worst grades ever and then evolved to the grad classes where I'm, you know, getting all A's, right?
Wow.
But you had to, you know, I had to learn the new expectation level, a new language, a new culture, you know, so there was so much more going on than just the academics of it.
And I think, you know, I think in any career that you hit that transition at some point. You go from like being a novice and then you hit this transition opportunity. I mean, even from a hosting standpoint and acting, like you go like, oh, now like this is kind of the big leagues now, right? Like Emmys and all that stuff. And there's a different kind of pressure that some, in a lot of cases, that pressure breaks people.
Yeah.
What was it about you that kept you going?
Oh, defiance. And don't get me wrong, I did quit twice. Right. But the way I quit made me come back. So, for example, I dropped out at Tougaloo College. So this is one of my famous stories. Right. I dropped out at Tougaloo College. And when you drop out, you had to go talk to a school official. Right. So it was me, my roommate, and this other guy. We all went and dropped out. Those guys were within 1 year of graduating. Right. So they were told, listen, you know, you really should stay. And then she tells me, she said, listen, I think you're doing the right thing. College is not for you. But I'm not sure. So go talk to the chaplain. And then he and I will talk after you talk to him, then I'll let you know.
Why did you want to drop out?
Because I wasn't smart enough. I in my mind, so, you know, I it was a struggle for me because literally I graduated high school not really even knowing algebra, right? And I went to the Navy first, and that's where I learned algebra. I was in this amazing program called Boost, right? That took people from parts of the country where the education isn't so good and gives you a year of intense academic training. Literally, you go from arithmetic through calculus in 1 year. Right. Wow. Yeah. And I mean, and so there were two levels of classes.
Wow.
I was in the lower level. And the thing that's really funny about that is that I was reunited. I've been at MIT on a sabbatical for the last year and a half. And it turns out that my old squad leader lived nearby. Right. And so I was in the dumb kids math class and he was in the smart kids math class. And we were laughing, you know, at the fact that, you know, now I'm this scientist and, you know,
you done changed.
What a great journey, though. What a great journey.
Yeah. So anyway, I dropped out and I got a job as a janitor working at the nearby hotel. And what ends up happening is the bellhop got fired. And, you know, I'd make more money as a bellhop than as a janitor. So I applied to the job and I didn't get it. I wasn't bellhop material, right? And so I thought to myself, I can't move up from janitor to bellhop. I'm going back to college, right? Okay. And I went back, and then, you know, I get to Stanford and the same thing happens. In my second quarter there, I got the lowest score on every midterm in every class. Mm-hmm. Right? And this was the semester where I first isolated myself, right? And that was it. And I'm like, I'm dropping out. And I went to my advisor's office to tell him, and he wasn't there. So I just sat on the floor in front of his door. And next door to him was another professor named Doug Osheroff, who ended up a little bit later winning the Nobel Prize in physics. And so Doug walks back and forth and out of his office a couple times, and he sees me there. And finally he says, what's wrong? And I said, I'm like, yeah, I'm dropping out. I'm not smart enough. And he's like, really?
And I can't be a bellhop.
Right. Failing at bellhop, not failing at physicist. Right. And he says, oh, really? Come into my office. What makes you think that? And I was like, well, I just took my midterms. I got the lowest score and everything. It's like, what class are you taking? I remember I was taking, quantum mechanics, partial differential equations, and linear algebra, right? The second level of linear algebra. And he says, tell me the topic. What are you doing in quantum? I tell him, he goes, okay, solve this problem. And he has a big blackboard in his office. And I solve it. And he goes, don't look so stupid to me, right? And he does this for problem after problem. And I just solve them all. And he's like, oh, just stick around and let's see how it works out for you, right? And it worked out.
That's
were
great.
Were you applying yourself?
Oh, was I ever? Like people used to tell me, like, you know, it was... So there was the physics library, and I would literally be working all overnight, every night in the physics library. People would come to the physics library, and they'd be like, Hakeem, stop working so hard, right? It was an ongoing joke. Like, but the thing about it that now, once you get it, right, and you're looking at it from that side, it becomes super easy.
So when was that point for you?
Well, that's an amazing thing, because people told me about that point, and it happened to me just as people said. So here's what happens. I walk into graduate school and you attend talks, scientific talks, and I never understood anything ever, right? And so, you know, you fall asleep and all this sort of thing. And then years later, I'm sitting in a colloquium, still a graduate student, and I'm like, oh my God, I understand everything.
No matter what it is,
I get it, you know? No matter what, I could have never seen it ever in my life. I now have the tools. And so that gets back to how we teach thought and logic and reasoning in our culture and in our school system. And basically we don't. So it's kind of hit and miss, right? Like for example, let me give you a common example. So, you know, when you're from communities where I'm from, you know, you're always being challenged, right? And people use their spirituality as a basis for challenging science, right? And they'll say something like this. Oh, you know, people say science knows whatever, but I had a friend, he was given 12 seconds to live and a man lived another 48 years, right? Yeah. Science doesn't know anything, right? And see, we're not taught, like if I were to ask you about the branches of science, right? So there are what are known as the formal sciences, mathematics, logic, computation. They're exact, right? If I write down the equation of a circle, that's a perfect circle. You can never create one in real life, but it's exact, right? Then you have the physical sciences, and at the top is physics. Then you have chemistry, and then you go down into the life sciences and the social sciences. And what people don't get and understand is how science is based on prediction, right? So let me give you an example of that. Suppose, I'm Isaac Newton and I write down, force equals mass times acceleration. That predicts the path of a baseball if I were to throw it, right? So I could take that equation and I can say, this predicts that if I throw a ball past the moon, it will curve in that way. Then I can throw a ball past the moon and either it does or it doesn't. And if it does, holy cow.
That was right.
It worked. Well, right. You're right to the extent that it has been tested. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, you know, you can build up millions of years of tests and then you're pretty convinced that it's correct. Right. And so when you make a prediction with science, then there is a number attached with it. Or if you make a measurement called the uncertainty. Right. And so for prediction in science, if you take quantum electrodynamics, you make a prediction and then you make a measurement. They agree to 15 decimal places. That's amazing. So suppose I look at you and I say, you weigh 202.4 pounds.
Wow.
That would be amazing if I could do that. Imagine if I could take that to 15 decimal places. Right? That's ultra amazing. But now, let's say, for example, that's in the physical sciences, where it's way up there at the top of the formal sciences, right? Now, let's say, for example, I make a prediction with the life sciences. I predict how long you're going to live. What's the uncertainty on that? The answer is it's plus or minus a lifetime, right? If I tell you have 2 months to live, you can die in another second or you could live to be 120 because there's so much uncertainty.
Sure.
Yeah. So anyway, I don't know what the point of that was.
No, it was great. I love how you get lost really in your own mind. I want to wait to see him like 40 years. Let me just go like, just check in on you. And be like, yep, he's lost in his mind again.
Absent-minded professor.
But I think that's also a good focal point, right? Because I think you have this power of presentation. One of my favorite moments I watched recently was you talking about infinity over the course of 3 minutes inside a prison.
Oh my God. Yeah. That was so awesome.
And it was,
not the talk. I mean, the experience.
I love myself too.
No, that's not what I meant.
No, but
you do a great job of mixing, and I wrote this in my notes, but you do a great job of mixing, huh? With, oh yeah, I know what he's talking about. Like I feel smarter being around you. And I think, I think that happens because you use like really heavy scientific terms, but then immediately I'm able to understand what they are. What's your technique to presenting science to laymen, right? And I think this happens also just for my audience, right? I think about the idea of like, I have a great business idea and it's all in my head and then I have to spew it out and I'm using jargon and it doesn't always translate.
Well, I'm from my community, and people don't talk like scientists talk in my community. And I don't feel the need to talk like a scientist, right? So like I said, a long time ago, I decided I'm just going to talk like me. So I'm a dude who grew up mostly in Mississippi. And when I go home, I talk to my, of course, how it is. When you're talking to your homies, your accent changes, right? The words you use changes. Yeah. The pace of speaking changes.
By the way, I said one thing to her in Spanish yesterday, and then she was like, blah, blah, blah. I was like, no. Nope, wrong guy.
But I don't have a technique. I just talk. And so I noticed it. So all of this, like being good at explaining science and all that, that all happened by accident, right? So it started again when I was in grad school. I was teaching a science class as a graduate student, astronomy at night. And so there were four nights and there were four different people that would run the observatory on each night. Right. And I started noticing that, the other nights would have like four or five students and my night would have like 20. Right. Mm-hmm. And which was a lot for that small observatory. And so I was wondering what's going on. And people said, hey, well, the rumor had gotten out that if you want to get an A in your science class, because if you're not a science major, you still have to take a science or two, then take Hakeem's astronomy class and you'll get an A, right? And so people thought that I was giving people A's. But here was the thing. I didn't grade anything, right? I didn't grade anything. I just told them, okay, let's just run the observatory. Let me help you with your analysis. I didn't give answers. The way I help a person when I'm tutoring them or educating them is I ask them questions, right, to help them guide themselves to the answer. So they were just doing better, right? And then I started at the end of grad school, my funding had run out, right? And so I started teaching at a nearby junior college, right? And after my, a couple of quarters, students started coming back to me and telling me exactly what you said. And so I have encapsulated this in a single phrase. People tell me, I thought I was dumb until I met you.
Wow. Right? Yep. That's the best compliment anyone can give you.
Or it's an insult if you think about it.
No.
But it's all contextual. You have to look at the context.
Exactly, I know, right? Exactly.
Right? No, but you're absolutely right. I phrase it that way so that it would be funny, right? Yeah. But and I'm talking about people. So when you teach at a junior college, you get people right out of high school. You get professionals. You get people that are older, that are changing professions. And you get people that are retired and they're trying to, just enlighten themselves and learn more. And these older people were coming to me. It's like, oh, I never thought of myself this way. Now I'm going to school full time. I'm going to be this. I'm going to be that. And so having an impact in people's lives gave me even more fulfillment than discovering things. Like I had already discovered stuff. And the first time you discover things, you're like, oh my God, I'm the only human who's figured this out, and it's really cool. Right. But then a moment after there's this terror, right. It's like, oh my God, what do I have to do next?
Yeah.
Now there's more pressure. Right. But when you impact people's lives, there's like no pressure. It's all happiness, right. It's all goodness.
Well, let's fast forward a little bit, or maybe just the steps from that point of like discovering who you are as a teacher, as a scientist, and eventually, eight television programs you've been on.
That's all?
He's a voice actor.
A voice actor. Yeah. You're the SpongeBob, right?
No. ExoTrex, coming soon to a school near you. Seriously.
Is that the scientific
name? It's a game I just developed with Digit Games called ExoTrex. And so there's a lot of games that help students to learn mathematics, but not a lot that help them to learn science, right? So we've developed Digit Games and our values are congruent.
I need those games in my life.
You need it. ExoTrex. Look it up. ExoTrex. We're doing a big release thing this coming month.
Yeah, so, I just wrote it out.
Right.
But
I voice it.
I love it. And I'm a fan.
All right. Good.
Is there a discount code?
No. For you there is, and for you too.
No, but like that transition of like kind of becoming an entertainment personality on top of it, what was the first few steps in that direction? Like what was the first phone call?
Listen, man, see, that's the other thing is that, I'm still me. I'm still the same guy. So let me tell you where entertainment started with me. popping and locking, right? So
listen, now's a good interview.
Hey, seriously, man, I used to break dance, right? And then I was in my high school band. So, you know, for, you know, the United States is a huge, diverse country, but in the South, we have this phenomenon.
South bands are a little different.
Yeah, we have this phenomenon of the all black marching band. Mm-hmm. So if you've seen Drumline, you get a hint of it. But I was a tuba player. And so if you know, drum and bass dominate. Right. And so, man, I'm talking about let's rock it out. Let's take it to the next level. So our you know, we got a nickname. People, even when I go back to Mississippi, people still talk about this. Right. So then I go to college and I'm a college DJ. Right. Scratching and mixing. Right. And I'm in my fraternity, you know, stepping and doing all this kind of performance. And I was always like the funny guy. Right. Through high school and everywhere. Right. I love to make people laugh.
Right.
So. What happened is my technical expertise led to my on-camera-ness. So when I joined the scientific advisory board, like I told you, the day I met right. Michio Kaku, after that, we had lunch. And at lunch, the head of the channel at the time was a woman named Debbie Myers. And typically, I'm really a shy guy, believe it or not, right? So in the crowds, I'm really shy. I keep to myself.
Really?
Yeah, I talk to like one person. But for the most part, like I'm good in front of a crowd. I'm good talking to one or two people. But if it's a room of people, you know, I typically kind of like, you know, keep to myself. So anyway, she wants to make me feel comfortable. So she comes over to me with her little staff, group of people. And she says, hey, Hakeem, tell me about your research. And I tell her, and immediately she turns to her staff and she goes, you see, that's what we need on the air. Hakeem, I have to put you on TV. Uh-huh. And she doesn't.
And you get all excited and then she was like,
Mama, I'm gonna be on TV.
I know, exactly. Yeah. No, listen, I understand her position because they had Michio, who was doing all of physics. They had Brian Cox, who was doing all of astronomy. Where does Hakeem fit? And then if you look at how I present myself, I'm not the stereotype of this is what it looks and sounds like.
But anyways,
right?
That's like the best intro to the entertainment world because you're gonna get rejected and people
right?
are gonna
tell
say
me about
like,
it.
All the time. They're gonna be like, oh, this is happening, and then nothing happens.
Oh, tell
right?
me about it. Yeah. Oh, but listen, when I first got into the, oh, I forgot, at the end of grad school, I started doing the voice acting thing. And that happened because my girlfriend at the time gave me this little newspaper clipping, because this is when, like, I'm almost 30 when I discovered that people think my voice sounds good, right? So it never sounded good to me. If I ever heard it recorded, I thought it was horrible, right? Which you probably experienced the same thing,
oh, yeah.
right?
I hate my voice.
So I get the voice acting gig. I take the voice acting class and I start getting auditions and gigs and this sort of thing, right? So performance had always been a part of it. And so what ended up happening is that it was the production companies that really broke me in. So Debbie asked me to do this show for this one production company called Atlas Media. And it was called Curiosities, Alien Invasion, Are We Ready? It was hosted by Michelle Rodriguez, right? So Michelle does the intro and then it cuts straight to me. Right. And I make my like deep opening statement. And I literally had told everybody I'd ever met in my life, I'm going to be on TV. Watch this. All right. And of course, I'm the opening guy. So it looks like, oh, Hakeem is about to have his big TV debut. For the rest of the show, I might have shown up 30 seconds or something. I don't know. Right. For
don't
like a 2-hour show. I know. Right. So I was like, that
You're
was like, a big disappointment.
Yes. And then it just cut to something.
But the interesting thing was that at the end of the interview, the producer goes, he goes, Hakeem, you're good at this, man. Why don't you do it more often? To which I responded, you tell me. So a year later, he contacted me to do another show. I went and recorded it. And I didn't tell anybody about it because I didn't want the same, you know, you don't know if you're going to show up or not, you know. And so the show comes out. I DVR it because it's weird for me to watch it, right? Watch myself on TV. 3 weeks later, I watched the show. It's a 2-hour docudrama, and I'm like the main guy in the show.
Wow.
Yeah. And then after that, like everybody started calling me to do, you know, science shows. But you know, you got to pick and choose.
I was going to say, and that becomes a time management, you know, mess, right? You want to teach, you want to do your research, you want to be traveling.
Well, I had already known how to navigate that because here's what happens is, you know, that phrase, if you want to get something done, ask somebody who's busy. Right. And so, you know, my research group, I had to learn to be more of a research manager and empower at different levels people to supervise people. And I had two amazing grad students, Bryce Orange and Dave Chesney, that were amazing. So at any one time, my research group would be 15 to 20 members. And, you know, without Dave and Bryce, you know, and then other responsible people under them, right, running things, Pat Champy, you know. And so what then happened is I had also been a member of all these different committees, this international science education stuff, international research stuff, service in America and all this. So I already knew how to do this balancing act of all this stuff. And TV is easy because it's a one-off. You know, just show up that day.
Right, and then boop, you're done.
And then you're done and then you go, right? It's not like signing up for a committee.
I wouldn't know. No one's ever asked me. I only have a face for radio.
Consider yourself lucky. Yeah. I resigned from all committees a little while ago.
You're like, I'm done with the committee.
Yeah, I'm like, yeah, this is
no longer committing to committees.
Exactly.
So switching gears another quick second before we start to wind down. You grew up in the Deep South, which is wrought with religion, right?
Oh, yeah.
And how do you look at the intersection of science and religion, right?
Yeah,
like, does one negate or prove the other, or how does that?
Well, you know, that's interesting because that always comes up, you know, and it's really interesting when, especially in certain parts of the world. I mean, whew, I'm telling you, I would go give these talks, and then I'll give you a few things. So people would say to me, sometimes kids would come up to me after, and I try to be really sensitive. And a kid would say, well, you know, professor, you said that science says this, but, you know, my holy book, whether it's typically it's the Bible or the Quran, right? Typically it's Muslims or Christians, says this, right? And I'll say, well, let me correct you here, young scholar. Science doesn't say anything. Science listens, right? Science listens to the universe and say, universe, tell me what you are, right? And what we report is what we observe it to be, all right? And not only that, understand what that means. So, here's an example. Suppose there's a problem with your car and you take it to an auto mechanic. You don't know if that auto mechanic is really good or really bad or whatever. That auto mechanic gives you, here's what's wrong with your car, right? You don't know whether or not you can trust it.
Right.
Suppose you took it to more auto mechanics. The more auto mechanics you take it to, then the more likely you're going to zero in on the right answer. Now, suppose you are 100% certain that the world's top auto mechanics are going to look at it in addition to everyone else, right? That's how science is.
Right.
You do some sort of study and you put your life's blood into it for a couple of years. Everybody is set on skeptical. Right. And everybody's set on prove it to me.
Right.
So anytime you present your scientific results, it is a massive hate fest. Right. And so when regular, you know, non-scientists see this process, they think that you guys are like angry at each other. Right. I mean, it happened in my PhD defense. This one guy, another Nobel Prize winner, Bob Laughlin, he was questioning me about something he didn't understand. And so to the lay people in the audience, they thought that he was kind of attacking me. Right. And so sometimes it gets heated. I kind of got a little bit heated and I answered him aggressively. Right. Yeah. And
did you knock his papers off the table?
No, not like that. I answered him aggressively and definitively.
Right.
And so in the aftermath, and listen, he was only seeking to understand. There was no battle. Right. And everybody's like, oh, you put him in this place. I was like, no, I didn't. No, that's not what happened there. He's a brilliant guy. And
science beef.
Yeah, it's no beef.
No, I know. Yeah, but it becomes
beefs.
A perception.
There are beefs, right? I mean, people are still humans. And,
you're right.
And so, you know, your what you present gets massively hated on. So now the question becomes, if you say, is there a conflict between religion and science? What you're really asking, is there a conflict between, you know, these faith traditions and what we observe to be true about the universe, right? So science is a report on what we observe to be true, plain and simple. So there is no like, you know, if for example, you say, like, if you look at the layperson who wants to challenge evolution is one of the common things, right? Or for example, the Big Bang. They're close to my field. Like I heard, this is one of my, TEDx talks in Orlando. This literally happened. I'm at a baggage claim in Johannesburg, South Africa, and this guy tells this other guy how his daughter told this guy, how could the earth be formed from an explosion? Don't explosions destroy things, right? And so what happens is that people don't really understand the science is the problem, right? And that's how so I think that these conflicts are all, you know, politicized and based on control and this sort of thing, and they don't really exist. Right. They don't really exist. Like, how can you have a conflict between this microphone is on this table or not? Right. That's science. I observe the microphone is on the table. Now, how can anything conflict with what I observe to be true?
Sure.
Yeah, it just doesn't. So in my own personal space, I think of it this way. I think of how the founding fathers of America looked at it. Right. And they said, hey, listen, you know, your religious faith beliefs are your own. So I think right now in science, there's these guys that go around trying to like shoot down people's faith and beliefs. You know, I'm not cool with that.
Yeah.
I think that everybody's cool to do what they want. But when it comes to science, right, it's not E equals MC squared in America and E equals MC cubed in Saudi Arabia.
Right.
It's E equals MC squared everywhere. Yeah. Right. And
I think, I think in general, like knowledge evolves it just over time. I mean, the science of yore is, you know, a little bit different than what we now know about certain things. And that continues to change. And I think the same thing happened, like as new discoveries come to the table, whether as an individual or as a giant organization, you know, that changes perspectives and all those things. Like
the trend is right.
Right.
But it's slow. And you know, that's a cool thing that gives me, sometimes I feel really cynical, and then sometimes I feel really hopeful, you know? And some of the trends, you know, are just, for example, one of the trends that give me hope. So there's a phrase I learned first from Rocky Cobb, but it's not his phrase. He's another physicist. But the phrase is not what you don't know, is what you know that ain't so.
Okay.
Right? You know, that's what really messes you up, right? And that's what really prevents you from making deep, insightful discoveries in physics. But for example, I just read a study. I haven't read follow-ups to it. And, you know, you have to vet everything, right? And you have to, like, you know, be really critical and rigorous so you don't accept, you know, I read a study and this is what it is, right? You don't just accept it like that. But sometimes if it holds up, you're like, oh, this is great. Okay, so one of them is the incarceration rate of African Americans. It's been declining for a long time. Would you have thought that?
Nope.
No,
this is what this study says. I would not have thought that either. Now, if you retrain your mind in that new paradigm, right, how does that change your perspective and how you see the world, you know, among other things? Or, for example, another thing that just came out, we'll see if it holds up, is perhaps there's evidence that there's now a fifth fundamental force, right?
Has it been robust, awakened?
Huh? Well, it operates on a microscopic level, just like
Star Wars. I'm sorry, guys.
Has a fourth been awakened?
Of course. Never mind.
Chris is such a nerd. How do you deal with this guy?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Sometimes the jokes don't even work. Just continue. No, the fifth force.
Yeah, but so for example, we've thought of the world. Another thing, for example, space. Right? Why do we think there's one space, right? We have this idea of parallel dimensions, but what about not parallel, but coexisting different spaces, right? I mean, you know, there's all these things that are both in human society and in understanding the world itself that, you know, the stories that we have in our minds and, you know, they sort of dictate what comes next.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, like people being intimidated by me. How does that happen? You know what I used to hate, man? I used to play basketball all the time, like all day, every day, dude, all the way up to, you know, forever, right? You know what I used to really hate is when some guy had to guard me and he looked at me and just gave up. Like before the ball bounced one time, he just gives up. I'm like, dude.
There's an office that I work out of and there's a basketball court there.
Yeah.
And I'm stuck in this like weird quagmire because of like if I do play and I'm great, then I prove a stereotype. And if I do play and I suck, then they're like, "Oh, you ruined it for all black people." Like you get so
it's a no-win situation.
Exactly.
See, you just hit on something there, right? And what you hit on is stereotype threat.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so this is something that is interesting. I discovered this in the 90s from a professor Steele at Stanford. So basically, what happens is, and apparently for some reason within our culture, African Americans suffer from this more than others, but you can impact people's performance by bringing up certain stereotypes. For example, one of the things they did is they gave math exams to students and they'd say something, you know, some stereotype, oh, Asians do better, right? And what they'd find was that white males would do worse. And then they would say, okay, not tell them that. And then they don't do worse. But it's even worse than that. If you even have to so much as check a box, indicate your race or right, that could make your performance high. But here's the thing that African Americans suffer from that others don't seem to suffer from as much, which is the thought of you're going to judge my entire race based on my performance or the behavior of other members of my race reflect on me instead of thinking as yourself as an individual and others as an individual. Right. And we, you know, and so you got to like identify these things and chuck them out of your brain.
Exactly.
Right. Chuck them out of your heart. No, they're not. They're not going to think of, you know. So,
well, at the end of the day, I'm a pretty shitty basketball player, so I would embarrass myself. Like
probably
that. So I'm like, I'm not. Hold on. You're not the only pop locker here.
Oh,
pass it around the table. There it is.
Oh, if you guys could have seen that, they were horrible.
You guys missed it.
No.
It was an impromptu dance routine. You've seen a lot from a very, you know, broad perspective, scientifically, worldly wise, culturally. What is one thing that you see out in the world right now that you personally have an innovation crush on? Like, what's something you see and you go, oh my gosh, that is amazing. I want to be,
Oh man. Yeah. So that's the problem with having my mindset. You know, whenever you see a nice talk about a new field or something like that, you're like, oh my God, I want to know more about this. I want to do that. So just doing this thing with DARPA, last week, cybersecurity, right? So, it turns out that here's the problem. So Turing, the Imitation Game was made on the movie, The Imitation Game was about Turing, right? The inventor of the computer. So Turing did this proof, mathematically, that showed that, you know, under certain constraints, you cannot have one piece of software that evaluates another piece of software and tells you what that software is going to do. And here's what I mean by what it's going to do. Supposing it doesn't crash, it can do one of two things. It can complete its job and stop, halt, as they say, H-A-L-T, or it can just keep on blah, 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 forever, right? And there's no piece of software you can write to evaluate that one to determine whether or not that's going to be what the outcome is going to be. So one consequence of that is that it's almost impossible to write software that can look at software and tell you whether or not it has a vulnerability that some bad person can take advantage of. So for example, assume that your virus control software has a vulnerability. So your virus control software has access to your entire computer, like the root administrative privileges, right? So what the bad guys would do is they'll break down that software and look at it line by line, and they find that vulnerability. Then they write an exploit, right? They write something to hack it, to take over your machine, to do their Bitcoin mining or whatever, right? Now, how long does it take the good guys to find out that this has happened? Almost a year, typically. The average is 312 days. And by that time, you know, whether it's...
You're doomed.
Yeah, some big bank has gotten hacked, or some big retailer online has gotten hacked, right? And so wouldn't it be great if there was software that you could write that could look at the software and tell and solve these vulnerabilities immediately? And then one vulnerability, right? When this thing hit the internet, in 10 minutes, it had infected 75,000 computers, right? No human, by the time it took you to open that thing had already spread across the internet. So right. This cybersecurity area looks like an area that's really important and really low-hanging fruit to come and make an impact.
I love that. In the most simplest terms here, or the most simple example, my website has been hacked 3 times.
There you go.
To the point where I'm like, you know what?
No website.
Forget, no website. Go to my Facebook, go to my Twitter, my Snapchat. Forget about the website. I'm not investing any more money on this.
Yeah, it's terrible. And they're out there. They're always looking. They're trying to get you. And if you become a target if you're public.
Yep.
Yeah.
Last but not least, breathe this conversation in, huh?
Oh, yeah. That was intense.
There you go. Complete this phrase for me. Innovation to me is...
Innovation to me is curiosity and need.
Curiosity and need. How do those things up against one another?
Well, sometimes you're just really curious and you're exploring and you're trying different things. And before you know it, you innovate it. Right? You're just having fun and you're just doing what you enjoy.
Got it. Yeah.
And then the next thing you know, you've made something.
Well, that's an important principle, right? I think I was thinking about this earlier as far as like entrepreneurs go, right? Sometimes you're trying to think of a business because you want to think of a smart business. And then there's that thing you're just passionate about and that's fun to you and you explore it. And then you put the business end on it later.
Right.
And it's just like you said, all these discoveries, the thing from the 30s, who knew that it would become part of a cell phone, you know, 60 years later. So that's a great comparison. How can people find you? Where are the interwebs on Hakeem Olushey? I love saying your name.
Hakeem
first of all.
Olushey.
Yes. Yeah. That sounded like you're walking slow motion on a beach. Hakeem Olushey.
On a horse.
Where do people find you?
On Twitter, I'm at Hakeem Olusheyi on Facebook. I'm Hakeem Olusheyi. And if you put my name in your favorite browser, you'll probably get my faculty webpage. And I don't yet have a website landing page. I you know, the forces.
I mean, look at you. You don't exist. Need one. Look at you. You are your landing page.
Well, but suppose, you know, somebody's like, hey, Hakeem, we need you. Right? Like Batman has that little thing he can project up in the sky.
We found you.
You know, yeah, but, you know, some people can, some people can't.
Yeah, but I didn't want you to find me. I want to. Oh, and Exotrex. One more time.
Exotrex. Oh, so let me tell you. Let me do my plugs. Yeah,
yes,
so we have Exotrex, the educational video game. Last year, if you want a space book for yourself with Time Life Books and Discovery, we published Spaceopedia, the guide to all things space.
Whoa.
Yeah, and so Outrageous Acts of Science is on right now, Wednesday nights on the Science Channel. And coming soon, How the Universe Works on the Science Channel.
I love it.
Yeah.
You know, you get an Emmy.
So much to learn. I love it.
Let's hang out. Let's learn. Yeah.
I'll just be staring at you like, what?
Okay. That might get boring for me.
No, you thought you were dumb until you met Hakeem.
Until I met Hakeem. Yeah. That's right, because that's what happens when you meet Hakeem.
You realize, I didn't notice this guy. Maybe I'm not dumb.
Gotcha. Everyone, this has been another installment of Innovation Crush. Thank you, Peely, for joining me.
Thank you, Chris.
I want to do this again.
Yes, let's do it again.
This has been another installment of Innovation Crush, and we will talk to you next time.